You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast. This is episode 24, and my name is Jason, and with me in conversation is Jamie. We are looking at the question, can we trust the New Testament documents? And more specifically, can we trust the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Now, the first thing I want to say is we want to look at why this matters. And it matters because Christianity is not just a feel-good, help you get over your problems, work up a good psyche kind of religion. It is a historical religion in that it is, or faith really, in that it's based on historical facts. And so therefore the accuracy of the historical documents that our faith relies on is essential. And the reality is that we as Christians should be able to talk about this and not be intimidated by facts and figures and scholars who will tell us that we can no longer trust the New Testament Gospels. We simply should not be goaded into believing that we can't rely on these documents when the Bible itself claims to be the Word of God, and we simply don't have a faith, we don't have a Christianity apart from these New Testament documents. And so the Gospels are important primarily because they are our chief source on the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. What it comes down to is very often it's around Christmas or Easter when a Newsweek magazine article or some cover story on a New York Times bestseller or something along those lines tells us that there's new evidence, and a lot of times it's a new gospel has been found, or there's new archaeological evidence that has disproved the gospels or caused us to doubt the veracity of the gospels, because these other apocryphal gospels give a very different story about who Jesus was and what he did and what he claimed about himself. And so because Christianity is all about Jesus, it's his life, his death, his resurrection, his claim to be the Son of God, all of that is central. So we have to get this right. We have to know if we can trust the Gospels. So first of all, I think it's worth going into a little thought experiment here, because what I see happening quite often, Jamie, is that probably millennials more than anybody, but also just the postmodern generation that's coming after us, has, I think, subtly and gradually bought into this whole idea that if something happened long ago, or if a document is very ancient, then somehow it's less reliable, or it has less validity in some way, or it has less significance for me in my life today. And I think a little thought experiment is worth considering. So who was the 16th president of the United States? Do you know offhand?
Let's see. So I think Andrew Johnson, maybe?
Abraham Lincoln.
No, that's close.
Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president of the United States. Now, how do we know that?
Because we have a historically documented timeline of presidents.
Right. I mean, any of the events we know about Abraham Lincoln, his life, his election to being the president, what the state of the nation was like at that time, the Civil War, all the events surrounding that, and the Emancipation Proclamation, the Gettysburg Address, all of that is based on written documents and eyewitness testimony. And really, if you think about it, okay, so the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was around over 150 years ago. But let's say, now, and we feel, just to kind of point this out, we feel very confident in these facts about Abraham Lincoln, that he really was the president. He really was the one who led our country through the Civil War, and he really did give the Gettysburg Address. All of these are facts that are just totally believed and taught and understood. So over 150 years ago, and we accept it. Now, if another 100 years were to pass, does that somehow make any of those facts less credible? Or, for example, would we in 300 years have good reason to now think that the Gettysburg Address was not given by Abraham Lincoln? No, of course not. The point is that 500 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years, it doesn't matter how much time has passed. That doesn't affect the credibility of what we know about Abraham Lincoln.
I think what you're getting at, at least in a historic sense. Now, I misguessed the president by one, so I don't know that I should really speak to historicity at this point. But when you learn history research as an academic study, we have what's called a bibliographical test, right? That's how you historically prove something to be true. And what that means really is the chain of documentation, right? So obviously the closer we can get to the actual event, the stronger the likelihood is that that's an accurate account, right? And so we look at, and the more documentation we have in that line of chain that we can look to and say, okay, this document we have today says this, says Abraham Lincoln was the president of the United States from 1860 to 1865, April, I think, something like that was when he was assassinated. And so we then look back to the bibliographical, and we're not speaking in a Bible context. Bibliographical is about the bibliography, the basically proven sources. I think that's the best way to say that. And we can link that all the way back to the actual election certificate of Abraham Lincoln itself. Or, like your example, the Gettysburg Address, we look for, okay, here are all the accounts of the Gettysburg Address, the actual language, word by word, and we can follow that chain back. Now, we don't have the original piece of paper, at least I'm not aware of, that Abraham Lincoln wrote the actual speech on, but we have all the eyewitness accounts, reports, and even the copies of the speech that were printed by newspapers, obviously given to them by the president or his staff. And then we work up from there. So then I look at, okay, here's the text I find on, let's say, Wikipedia, and here's the actual original print of the speech itself. And if the words and the language are the same, then I have every confidence that speech is the one that was given by Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg in, 1863, I think?
Right, in the middle of the Civil War, yep. Yeah, so, I mean, that's exactly my point, that just because something happened a very long time ago, and just because we don't have the original manuscripts, and I don't know for a fact either whether or not we have the Gettysburg Address, the original document that he read from, probably not. But so even if we didn't, that doesn't hurt our recognition of that we do know, in fact, what he said. And we do, in fact, know the events of the Civil War that surrounded and led to him giving that address in the first place. And so I guess the point being, history is, I mean, the vast majority of what we know about history is based on eyewitness testimony. Not all of it, obviously. But I would say the great majority of what we know about anything in history is based on eyewitness testimony. And we have often this situation where we don't have the original record or the original manuscript or whatever you have. But that's okay. And that doesn't need to, that we shouldn't be bothered by that. And in fact, I think what we have for the, as we'll talk about shortly here, about the New Testament, the multiplicity of manuscripts that we have for the New Testament is just incredible. And I'll explain how that actually lends a whole lot of credibility to us knowing, in fact, what was written down in the original copies, also known as the autographs. Okay, so certain scholars, Bart Ehrman is obviously a well-known scholar who would address this issue. He says, basically, when he addresses this issue, he says that Jesus never actually claimed to be God. That, in fact, what we know of Jesus today in terms of him being the Son of God and that he was worshipped and all of that, that was a late invention. This is according to Bart Ehrman. And he says that essentially there was this development of tradition and this tradition surrounding the person of Jesus and what he did was it evolved over time. And so he uses this analogy of the telephone game. And Jamie, I don't know if you've played this game, but I remember playing this game many a time, you know, in third, fourth grade, where essentially you have a chain of people giving a message one to another. And you want to, the idea is, I mean, obviously it's kind of a fun game where you're just trying to see how well the message stays intact from the first person all the way down the chain to the last person. But he uses this as sort of an analogy of what it was like for this tradition about Jesus, that certain attributes of Jesus were sort of morphed and the understanding of who Jesus was sort of became garbled and changed over time as people spread these stories around. And then the Gospels were written. And in Ehrman's view, which I totally don't accept, is that they weren't even written as historical biographies about Jesus, but rather they were more written as theological treatises that weren't necessarily even written by the traditional authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay, so that's sort of the charge that is made, that this telephone game analogy is what works for, or is a good representation. And here's the problem. I mean, there's a number of problems, but to begin with, in order for a tradition to be passed on in this culture, this time in the first century, people had to be memorizing what had happened. And oftentimes, this was the regular practice for Jewish people, that they would, if a student of a rabbi hung around him and learned his teachings, he would memorize his sayings, and he would basically tuck that away in his memory, and he didn't even have to write it down because he would just orally remember and then pass it on to someone else. Now, there's evidence within the Gospels themselves that already while Jesus was still on earth, his followers were proclaiming his teachings. There's times, like for instance, Matthew 10 and Luke 9 and other places where we're told that Jesus sent out his followers to proclaim the kingdom that he himself had been proclaiming. Okay, and so there's good reason to think if they're going out and they're teaching what Jesus taught to others, they are having to memorize a lot of these sayings. They're having to basically digest what Jesus has told them so they can explain that to others. You know, that's a great way to learn something, is to force yourself to teach it to others. And so in this culture, it was very common to memorize sayings and stories. Jesus often taught with parables that had this very easy to memorize feature about them, in that you could get the basic understanding of the lesson, if you will, or basically the kingdom of God being taught about through these parables, which were easily memorized and repeated. Okay, so you have that. You have this oral tradition that's actually way different than the telephone game, because they actually wanted to memorize. They wanted to get this right. They were followers of Jesus, not just playing a simple children's game. But you also have to consider the fact that if you have at least 12, and there were at least 12 apostles at the beginning, then you have to consider that, okay, so they were going out and proclaiming this same message. They want to verify with one another. Are we all saying the same thing? And that's just kind of a basic rule of thumb. You're not going to make any headway if you're all saying different things. And so, again, it's not a fair analogy, because, A, this is a life and death matter in their eyes. This is about eternal life, knowing who Jesus is. And B, they are working together to spread this message, and they're doing it even while Jesus is still alive. Jamie, why don't you jump in? What are some thoughts you have just as I'm sharing some of this?
Yeah, I think that's really good. In terms of the text itself, or the number of copies, that is something you said you were going to get into a little bit here in a minute. But I think going back to that bibliographical test idea, the more copies we have, the better, right? So we want to see, okay, here was the authors of the Gospels or the biblical books, the apostles or those associated with the apostles, like Luke, obviously wasn't written by an apostle, but it was written by an associate of Paul, who wrote, the book of Luke and the book of Acts. And so then we want to see a train of additional copies, so that we can go, okay, are they continuing the, let's say, oral tradition or written tradition? We want to see that there's not a lot of variance over time. And I remember in Josh McDowell's book, what's the name of it?
Evidence That Demands a Verdict?
Yes, yeah. In that book, I think he talked about how there's, not the original version, but the updated version. He said there's like 66,000 copies of the biblical text. I mean, obviously not just the four Gospels, but point being, we have a massive trend of copies to look at. And the incredible accuracy from one copy to another copy is so good. That it's just, almost ridiculous. I think one of the examples I remember him using in the book was the Dead Sea Scrolls to another copy of the Old Testament that was done around 1100 or something like that. And so there's basically like a 1,000-year difference between these two copies. And what they found with the book of Isaiah, which is the largest complete biblical book that was found, was that in the variance difference between those two copies, which were done 1,100 years apart, obviously weren't using each other. The difference was basically it came down to three lettered characters, not words. But three-lettered characters were the only ones that were a variance. Like, that's not even a scorable statistical difference. And that's over a span of, 1,000 years. So this idea that the apostles shared what Jesus taught them, and then other people heard that and shared what they heard from what they said, and then those guys shared, and so on and so forth. And so we have no relationship between the original words of Jesus and what we have in our Bible today is just absolutely nonsense.
Right. Well, and I think there's a lot of holes that I just want to point out in Ehrman's whole theory too. So starting with this, he claims that the original Gospels, which we call Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he claims that those were anonymous originally, and that the only reason why they have that they're ascribed to the men they are today is to give them that sense of authority in the early church. Okay, so that's his claim. So here's some problems with that. Number one, and this is a big one, we don't have a single New Testament, we don't have a single gospel manuscript that does not have the traditional names attached to them. In other words, we don't have a single anonymous gospel of all the manuscripts we have. This is incredible that he would even make this claim. New Testament scholar Michael Bird made this statement. He says, there is an absolute uniformity in the authors attributed to the four Gospels. Matthew is always called Matthew. Luke is always called Luke, and so forth. So in other words, just like with the Psalms, you probably have seen this, that they have this superscript where the Psalm is attributed to David or the sons of Korah or someone like that. In the same way, every single Gospel manuscript we have ever found has the traditional author in the superscript, where it'll say Euangelion kata Matthaeon, or the gospel according to Matthew, and so forth. And so for him to make this, really, it's an outrageous claim to say that they were originally anonymous and that these names were simply attached to give them authority in the early church. That is just, I mean, it's really, to me, it's just a sign of his unbelievable bias against their authenticity, that he would look for, you know, any hole possible, and really just the historical evidence doesn't support that claim.
Well, it's important to note, not only is the historical evidence from the church backing up those claims, yep, these were the authors and the apostolic authority by which, you know, these gospels were included in the canon, but there's also a wealth of non-faith folks of that time, contemporaries or historians, that also speak about these books and their authorship. So it's not like, you know, one of the greatest evidences for the resurrection of Jesus is the fact that we have, you know, the Apostle Paul, James, the brother of Jesus, and Jude, the brother of Jesus, three guys who did not believe Jesus to be Messiah. And in at least two of their cases, you know, James and Jude believed Jesus to be crazy. So right. The fact that all three of them end up going to their death proclaiming Jesus is Messiah, he was risen from the dead, attesting to the fact that what Jesus said is true. The same holds true in a historic sense. We don't just look at the history church tradition to determine whether this authorship is correct. We also look at the non-Christian historians and counterparts that also wrote about these books and their authorship. And, you know, whether skeptical or not, they're still affirming the reality that these are the actual authors of the books.
Exactly. Well, and he's not the only one who makes this claim. I mean, Reza Aslan in his book Zealot, where he gives this totally false view about who Jesus was and really this distorted wrong teaching about what Jesus was like. He says at the very beginning of his book that we have no idea who wrote the original Gospels. And that's just such a blatant misrepresentation of the facts. If we have a complete uniformity in the authors ascribed to each one of the Gospels, it doesn't make sense to say we have no idea. Like, oh, we're totally clueless about this. You know, to me, it's just his own biases showing through when he says something like that. And I think that part of the problem is, you know, if you have a wide number of people who are essentially saying the traditional understanding of both what what the Gospels say and who wrote them is true. And a lot of people are saying, yeah, this is all correct. The traditional understanding is true. They're not going to be on the bestsellers list. So there's this motivation to come up with something that is kind of radical and shocking. And really that shock value puts you on the bestsellers list because, oh, wait, here's this new understanding of Jesus and the Gospels we had no idea about. So,
well, and we'll keep in mind, too, that these are the same historians or theologians or, you know, whatever they consider themselves that will argue with books of the Bible that have specific authorship inherently written into them. Like, I think it's like Colossians is one of the ones that I've heard people say, we don't know who the authorship is, even though it's signed by Paul himself. And you're going, how do you possibly not know who the author is? So it's like, you know, it's almost intellectual dishonesty in a lot of those kind of arguments. But I don't feel like that argument is really as common anymore. It seems like most of the criticisms I hear, at least in a modern day context, and granted, I don't spend as much time listening to what scholars are saying. We spend more time listening to what, you know, people in our communities are saying, because it's them that we're sharing the gospel with. You know, it's them we're contending for the gospel with. And the more common, like, critiques I hear are, like, about textual variants. You know, like, John chapter 8, for example, you have the story, I think it's John chapter 8, right, where you have the story of the woman that's brought to Jesus. And in some of the oldest manuscripts, you know, that story only begins with Jesus talking about being the light of the world, and that story is not originally included. And so they talk about those kind of differences to disqualify the Gospels.
Here's the irony, though, with that one, Jamie, is the only reason we know that about John chapter 8, that account was not originally included in the Gospel of John, is because of Christian scholarship. It's not as if some liberal scholar said, oh, look, you guys have been missing this the whole time. No, it was Christian scholars who had been doing their homework and actually paying attention to all the manuscripts. And again, we have an incredible wealth of manuscripts. But that's the only reason that was identified. It wasn't as if this, like, blindsided Christian scholars. This was something that we discovered. And I think that often it's portrayed in the opposite light, that this is something that we were, you know, somehow covering up, the church didn't want people to know. But if you open up your Bible, any modern translation will tell you that that section of John 8 was probably not included, or it'll say something about the earliest manuscripts do not include this portion of scripture. Same with the end of Mark.
Yeah. And the other thing you hear all the time is in relationship to the timeline variance between, you know, when the Gospels place certain events. And that one, I think, is just even less compelling, because that's thinking of the Gospels as if they are only narrative histories, right? Like, they're only attempting to plot out the life and ministry of Jesus in a chronological order for the purpose of letting you know, hey, here's what Jesus' ministry looked like. But that's not how the Gospels are written. In fact, each of the Gospels is written with a theological perspective. So the author is arguing something to you, and in most of them, the author specifically gives you outright what it is, the thesis, so to speak, the what, you know, why are they writing this, so that you can have that, like, understanding of, okay, what are they getting at? I'm thinking of, like, since we're talking about the book of John, in John chapter 20, verse 31, he says, these things were written so that you may believe Jesus is Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. And that's really the thesis of the book, and you see it played out. I mean, he begins the book with, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," and builds on that theme throughout the whole book. His whole goal is to lead you to understand emphatically that Jesus is Messiah, and here's the proof of it. It sort of culminates with Lazarus being raised from the dead. You know, up until that point in the narrative of John, the people Jesus had raised from the dead had all just died. And so you could reasonably come along and say, well, obviously we've seen examples of people who had died and then had been brought back to life, you know, right away. Certainly we know in our modern context that can happen. A heart can stop and it can be in some cases restarted and somebody can go on living. But Lazarus is a case where the guy had been dead for 4 days. So he wasn't just dead. He was dead, dead, dead. Like everybody agreed he was completely, totally, irreversibly dead. And Jesus raised him from the dead, declaring himself to be the resurrection and life. And then further proving that with his own resurrection. And so John can emphatically argues that Jesus is Messiah because he proves it. He proves it in every single way. And so it's not meant for just giving you an account of what Jesus' ministry looked like. They use a lot of these stories as it fits their narrative or their argument more than a chronological accounting of Jesus' life and ministry. I think another example of that is in like Luke 19. You get the story of Zacchaeus, who I believe Luke is trying to draw a compare and contrast with the chapter before, Luke 18, where he presents for us the rich young ruler, this guy who asked Jesus, "What must he do to be saved?" And the similarities and differences between these two really rich guys in these two chapters is really important. And certainly the author is trying to show us something. And yet those two events aren't back to back in the life of Jesus' ministry. And so they're not just chronological tellings of what Jesus did.
Right. Well, and this is a good point because the gospel writers never make any other claim than that they are making a theological argument for Jesus being the Messiah and Son of God, but that doesn't take away at all from it being a historical work. And this was a normal practice for ancient biographies, which more and more scholars, by the way, are recognizing that the Gospels do fall into this category of ancient Greco-Roman biographies, just the way they're laid out, their length, and the genre. But that they had the freedom when they wrote these biographies back in the first century, in that time span, they had the freedom to write them in a thematic arrangement rather than a strictly chronological arrangement. And that's very different. We look at that today and we say, oh, that's not how a biography ought to be written. But that's just because in our culture and with our conventions for the way that we write biographies today, you know, we have footnotes, we have, you know, a certain chronological order to everything, most always anyway. But that wasn't the way that biographies were always written in the first century. And there's even times when I believe it is Tacitus makes this point. He says, look, guys, I'm not even trying to give you a chronological telling of these Caesars. I just want to highlight some of the themes in their lives. And so if that's a normal accepted practice in that culture in that time, then we shouldn't be saying, oh, then therefore these gospels are not historical because they don't fit our standards of what a biography should look like.
Well, I don't think that's even all that unique to that culture, you know, because when we make arguments today, like let's say we were to go to court, right? And if I am, let's say, defending you in court, and I'm trying to show, for example, let's say I'm trying to prove that you're a really good father to your boys, I might use certain stories in a certain order that better paint the picture for how you are as a dad and father. Now, everything I'm saying is still totally true. It just doesn't necessarily mean that I'm presenting it exactly in the order that it transpired, because that's not my goal. My goal isn't to count out, how it went down exactly. My goal is to show, oh no, let's say in this case, you're accused of something and I'm trying to say you're not guilty of it because of your character as a dad. I'm presenting these stories. You know, do you see what I'm saying? So I don't think this is as foreign a concept to us.
Sure.
Even today.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, I guess the point being, even by our modern standards, these kind of recollections brought in a thematic way, as opposed to a chronological way, is acceptable. We don't suddenly discount it and say, oh, that's not historical, simply because it doesn't follow some strict standard by which it never should have been trying to fit into anyway. And I think it's worth also noting, I mentioned earlier that every single New Testament manuscript we have attributes the Gospels to the traditional authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I think it's also worth mentioning that the early church fathers were also unanimous in attributing Matthew to Matthew, Mark to Mark, and so forth. And so these early church fathers writing in the first few centuries of the early church are so significant because here they are, they're picking up right after the apostles are off the scene, and they're writing about these documents, and they're calling them things like Holy Scripture or the words of the living God. And they're attributing them again to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So there's no reason really to say we have no idea who wrote these, when we absolutely do know who wrote them. And there would be the only way we could come up with some kind of conclusion that we have no idea who it is that wrote these Gospels is if we had our own arbitrary standard that simply would not fit for the vast majority of historical documents from the ancient world. And I think that, you know, we're running out of time, but I just want to point out a couple things just real briefly about our manuscripts, since I promised I would say something about that. So in Greek alone, and just maybe for those who don't know, a manuscript would be a handwritten copy of the Gospel or of a New Testament document in general. And so when I say we have a certain number of manuscripts, I'm saying these are not the original copies, but these are handwritten, or not the original documents, but these are handwritten copies of those documents. And so in Greek alone, and this is from Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict, we have 5,856 manuscripts existing today. And so they are continually being found. It's amazing how this number has gone up even in my lifetime, as we've discovered through different archaeological digs and so forth, we've discovered more and more manuscripts. So this number is only growing. But the amazing thing about this number of 5,856 manuscripts in the Greek is that these were found all over the Mediterranean world. That's significant because if they were all found in one location, then someone could come up with a hypothesis that maybe, just maybe, these were, that the early church was somehow controlling what these documents said, and therefore sort of playing with the facts and making sure it fit exactly what the church wanted them to say, even if that's not what they originally said. But that doesn't work if we're finding these in a vast number of different areas around the Mediterranean, and they are all lining up. In other words, yes, there are textual variants, but, and I'm not gonna have time to get into all this, but those textual variants in no way affect the theological meaning of any of the New Testament documents. And so that's important, because a variant could be a misspelled word. It could be saying him instead of saying Jesus, when you know the him is referring to Jesus. Different things like that. These variants, even though they're drastically exaggerated in terms of their impact on the gospel's reliability, the reality is that these variants don't affect the actual meaning, and it's very easy to come to the meaning, except for about 2%. Even in that 2%, the theological meaning, in other words, a core doctrine of the faith is not in peril. It's simply, did they go into Jericho this way or that way? You know, something along those lines. And so that's important, because we as Christians need to know that we have every reason to be confident, not only about who wrote these gospels, but that they have been recorded accurately, that they have stood the test of time, and that they were copied in a very accurate and careful fashion. These scribes were wanting to preserve these doctrines that they cherished. And so that's why we see these manuscripts lining up. And I said 5,856 of the Greek, but in total, this is pretty impressive, in total we have 23,986 manuscripts, and that includes other languages like Latin, Syriac, Coptic, and Slavic, and others. Now, as a way of comparison, the Iliad by Homer had 1,800 manuscripts, currently has 1,800 manuscripts, and nobody doubts the accuracy or the reliability of those documents. Obviously, the Iliad is recording an epic poem, not a historical biography. But the point remains that people don't doubt, you know, that we have the original recorded words of Homer because of these manuscripts. And in the same way, we have no reason to doubt that we have the original. All but, as I said, about 2% of the New Testament is in question. And even then, there's some pretty good answers out there. And so we have good reason to rely on the translations that we have today, because they are making use of these 23,000 manuscripts that we have out there. We'll have to continue this conversation, pick it up next week. There's a lot more to say on this.
You've been listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you want to subscribe, feel free to do so on iTunes or Google Play. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to hit us up on social media or send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. To hear past episodes, go to our website, faithunpacked.com. And as always, we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.